Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Glenn and Helen Show. There's been a lot going around the world militarily, and we've got our favorite experts on the subject here to talk about it, and about how Montgomery Ward played a role in stopping terrorism.
We'll be talking with syndicated columnist Austin Bay and StrategyPage.com publisher Jim Dunnigan about the London terror bus, events in Lebanon and Iraq, and more.
We've got Austin Bay and Jim Dunnigan on the phone now. Hi, guys.
Hi, Glenn. How are you?
Hi, Austin.
Hi, Glenn. Hi, Helen.
Hey,
hi,
how are you doing?
Hi, Helen.
Well, let's start out with, we've had a terror plot busted, and arrests seem to be going on in Britain, the United States, Italy, and some people wonder if there's an Iranian connection. What's going on?
Probably not an Iranian connection to this. Apparently, the Pakistanis are heavily involved in this. And the British have been doing an intelligence operation that is basically vacuuming the internet and every other source they can lay their hands on. They have no compunctions about that sort of thing over there. Well, if they do, the government doesn't pay attention to it. Apparently they had most of the people they arrested already on their radar. From what I can tell, from official and unofficial sources, the Pakistanis, who are very much at war with Al-Qaeda, not with Islamic militants and terrorists, because they have some of their own they have to be nice to, but Al-Qaeda has declared war on the Pakistani government, which is always a bad thing in a country you're trying to operate from, and they regularly arrest suspected Al-Qaeda people, and they especially pay attention to Pakistani, British nationality, and they caught one who had basically had the plot, all over him, whether it was in documents or in incriminating telephone conversations or whatever. They immediately got in touch with the British, and the next thing you know, it's very difficult to get on an airplane.
I don't think Iran is implicated, at least in what I've seen so far, vis-a-vis the great British airport terrorist strike, the alleged one. I think Jim's analysis is dead on. Al-Qaeda with links through Pakistan. I do want to make note of a couple of things that I've been able to glean from reports about the British methods. I think the British are very good. Jim essentially said they've taken a multi-spectrum approach. One of the things that it appears to me they've done is look very closely at the individual contacts of key participants. In other words, they make a diagram of personal connections, and these can ultimately be very, very elaborate. How many people does this certain individual come in contact with? And they try to literally log every contact the person has, and then you build from the contact, the person contacted, to the next person's network. And this is very involved, very tedious police work, but New Scotland Yard and MI5 are very good at it. I'm sure they use as many digital aids as they possibly can, so they build an extraordinary database on these individuals. And then on top of that database of connections, they start looking at credit card use, all financial transactions. They look at all the communications that they can get their hands on or get their ears to with telephonic communications, and as Jim said, the internet. So I think that's we've seen the payoff of not just a break, and apparently there was a break in Pakistan with picking up one of the plotters, but also the payoff for meticulous, careful, thorough, and very professional police and intelligence work, so they know where that network goes.
Something else to keep in mind that often gets, confused in the United States, that a lot of this connectivity analysis actually comes from the commercial sector. Those people we all love to hate, the junk mail people, they developed this, and indeed this whole field was developed a century ago by the Montgomery Ward and the other people doing catalog selling. And this sort of analysis has just, gone on from generation to generation. and all the Department of Defense and the CIA were trying to do with it was simply apply it to counterterrorism. Of course, Congress immediately slapped them down because it was impinging on somebody's privacy. But let me tell you, your privacy is already toast as far as marketers go. Now, you can't come down on the marketers because they have lobbyists and lawyers and their own public relations people, and they're not as afraid of, you know, the privacy activists as politicians are. The British not only had that to depend on, but they also had the experience of the Germans in the 1970s when they used those very same techniques, which were rather more primitive 30 years ago, to hunt down the Bader-Meinhof and the various other, you know, middle-class terrorists that they had on their own soil. And when they got rid of them, they got rid of that analysis section in their intelligence organizations because, again, they felt that it was smacked too much of the Gestapo. Yes, the Gestapo used that sort of stuff, too, and there were several books on that about IBM sold them the computers and the card equipment and all that stuff. Be that as it may, there's nothing new under the sun, and if you do use this stuff, you have an enormous edge over the terrorists because it's almost impossible to escape a net like this that is tossed out.
But didn't a British Muslim sort of break this case? I mean, wasn't the major tip they received from an informant?
Well, apparently what they got in Pakistan was a tip off that the thing that they had a lead on, the plot, as it were, was about to come off. In other words, they knew something was in the works. They had a lot of people under surveillance. But this guy in Pakistan apparently let loose that they were actually doing the training of the people to mix the chemicals. Now, this has been a major problem. In fact, we did a piece on it today or yesterday at Strategy Page, where we pointed out that the biggest weakness in these terrorist operations are what they call the engineer. For example, the Israelis shut down the Palestinian terrorist campaign against Israel 2 years ago by identifying the technicians, the people who could build bombs, and there aren't that many of them, and what the Palestinians like to call the engineers. In some cases, they are literally engineers, and killing them or arresting them. This is the one weak point that Al-Qaeda knows it has, and this is one of the big reasons for going after the camps in Afghanistan, because one thing they were doing there was recruiting and training bomb builders. It's much more difficult to do that. And a bomb using liquid explosives is much more difficult to put together than one using, you know, plastique.
Let me actually...
Glenn, could I pick up on something? I mean, that Jim just said, though?
Yeah.
I have to come back and use Branch Rickey's, the Dodgers' famous general manager's line: "Luck is the residue of design." And this is some way another approach to answering Helen's question. Is you have all of this background analysis that Jim and I have described when I talked about personal connections, and Jim talked about the broader connectivity analysis. This is the good hardcore police and gumshoe level intelligence work that you must do so that you can take advantage of a break, whether that break is a walk-in, someone that comes in and turns in specific information that gives you the missing piece, so to speak, of the puzzle, or whether you capture somebody, and that's what Jim and I, and based on what we've seen in the press and on the internet, concluded happened in Pakistan. But if you haven't done all this other work and done some of the basic collection work, Dunnigan's already commented on some of the friction that you run into here in the United States, and yet a lot of that information is it's legal to collect it. It's legal to assemble it and assimilate it, and if it weren't, then the police wouldn't have a chance against, let's say, the average intelligence crook, much less organized crime, because it's the same kind of techniques that they used in documenting the crimes and gaining evidence against organized crime outfits.
Although, in one of those great ironies, the police departments in general were late to realize the usefulness of these techniques. I mean,
the organized crime. Task forces weren't, though, Jim.
Yes, I know,
but guys were really on top of it.
20-30 years ago, there literally was no knowledge of these tools among most police forces. You know, unless you had a brother who was in marketing with Sears Roebuck, you didn't know this kind of power existed. But as the police departments found out about it, and of course the FBI was a little, you know, way behind the curve as well. They don't like to talk about that. But once they found out about this stuff, that's when you saw a lot more of the major crime organizations going down, because all of a sudden they were vulnerable on far more fronts, as it were, than they were previously. A couple of good accountants and lawyers could no longer keep them clean.
And the operational component of those, it was these combined organized crime task forces, where you had people that understood the necessity of doing this work and knew how to apply it to the organization.
Yeah, but of course, another point Austin is making is that you have to have somebody who's going to recognize the breakthrough. We now know that the 9/11 crew, those 19 people, a lot of them were on the radar.
But
nobody said, hey, you know, this is kind of suspicious. Guys wanted to learn how to take fly airplanes but not land them.
But don't you think that's sort of the American mentality? Everybody, don't get into somebody's business. I see that all the time in communities and places. People are kind of embarrassed or they're afraid something will happen to them. We've always been taught, don't, you know, mess with somebody's kid down the street. Don't talk to anybody. I mean, I think there's more and more of that. We also don't know each other as well. People move around a lot in the United States.
Actually, I tend to disagree with that. Okay. I know people are saying now that we've got the internet and DVDs and everything, people are more isolated, but I think they're actually more connected.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the entire new world of connectivity that's come about because of the internet. You know, sure, we don't have all the old organizations, the volunteer fire departments and what have you. They're all dying, but you have many more new organizations, online, virtual, but a lot of these people get together face-to-face. So texting has replaced, you know, the PTA.
Well, let's give Helen her due, though, on the point about the American reluctance to say...
I think it's political. I mean, That's exactly what it is.
Yeah, but the privacy thing is all false, because there is no privacy.
Well,
the people who are talking about... No, it's ironic. They talk about we've lost, you know, this privacy and the government's going to do this, the government do that. Two things they forget. First, the privacy has been gone a long time ago. Second of all, the government are the people who are most vulnerable to screwing up with any of this information, because the media and all the other politicians dive right on you. If a private company... You know, a credit card company or a credit reporting company, something like, if they have any problem, they immediately throw a lot of PR specialists at it and lobbyists, and it goes away.
Jim,
politicians can't do that.
Her point, though, is one that is the source of a great deal of, I will say, legitimate concern as well as political friction about using some of these techniques for the legitimate and legal application against terrorists, though.
Well, they are using them, but they're not talking about it.
When they talk about it, you end up with
no kind of
situations. About the New York Times blowing the legal and legitimate and productive counterterror operation with a SWIFT operation in...
Well, that's because they know they can't get prosecuted. But what the New York Times doesn't like to report, which they could, is the fact that a lot of these services are being contracted out to private companies. You know, the marketing companies and what have you, and the counterterrorism people are still getting the kind of information they need. The reason, now, I don't know exactly why the New York Times doesn't report, but mainly I think it's because it's embarrassing. They're saying, yes, they're still doing it, and there's nothing anybody can do about it.
Well, let me ask quickly on this front. Isn't there sort of a contradiction with all of this? You hear from people who oppose, for example, the invasion of Iraq, that we should be using intelligence and law enforcement techniques to go directly after the terrorists. But whenever people do this sort of thing, we hear objections about privacy.
Well, that's all about not liking George Bush or the Republicans being in power.
I'll let Dunnigan say that.
I'm a registered Democrat, by the way. I don't mind admitting it.
Yeah, but Jim,
Democrats in New York City are not talking about logic. They're not talking about right or wrong. They're talking about being out of power.
Jim, you are a defense Democrat from the word go.
The only reason I'm a registered Democrat is I get to vote against the liberals twice.
Well, the thing is, though, is that if there was a defense Democrat that I know, and Jim can say whether he's a Democrat anymore, and Jim is one. I would say like Joe Lieberman, as a matter of fact.
Exactly.
I think you're very much in leadership.
And why did they go after Joe Lieberman? Not because of his voting record,
but because he liked George Bush.
Basically backed a sane policy against people who are basically insane with rage.
Well, let's move back to the question, though, which is a really it's a very important one that both Glenn and Helen have posed here, which is, all right, we want you to use law enforcement techniques, which we've described. Jim and I have even described kind of an operational, even get into some of the tactical elements of it, and intelligence techniques, intelligence capabilities and operations to stop these terrorists. But when you start using them, oh, we're afraid. I think Jim has given an absolutely honest and direct answer about some of the friction at the national level. But Helen's point about an American tendency, and I recognize this in myself. I think it's actually something that I think is admirable in the American character, which is your home is your castle. You are allowed your own privacy, and you are allowed your own liberty. The problem that we face, and it's brought clear to us on 9/11, is that we have an implacable, and I'll use the same words Jim has used in a couple of really fine pieces that we've had on Strategy Page. You have a nihilist death cult, a peculiar ideology, the Islamo-fascist ideology, that uses and leverages these own individual liberties and these tendencies here in the United States against them. They're implacable. So what do you have to do? You have to, and this is another difficult word. It sounds a little bit psychologist, but Helen, you can correct us if I'm misusing it. You have to take a mature adult approach to saying, we've got these tools, we're going to direct them at what we believe to be the most clearest threat, because these are the only tools that ultimately protect us against that terrorist threat. It's not going to ever be balanced, in my view, rhetorically and on the front page of the New York Times, but somewhere in the FBI, CIA, there's a combination of respect for those American desires, but the realization that you have to use these techniques to stop these guys.
Mm-hmm. But I always find it interesting just looking at, for example, school violence. People are really big on invading the privacy of kids, their homes, anything to stop a school shooter, yet they won't use the same techniques for terrorists. I mean, for example, I've actually had kids where they'll literally barge into their home to inspect their home to see what kinds of weapons they have. And some of them without a warrant, and they've done it and gotten away with it. But people say, good for them. You know, I've never heard, you know, nobody has a problem with that. But when it comes to using those same types of techniques with terrorists, people don't want to do that.
Well, because you have people who want to be secular saints. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of people in the ACLU, and they really believe they're on a crusade. Well, maybe they wouldn't use that word because it's not PC. But they're basically out to transcend, you know, moral behavior by setting themselves up as the absolute, you know, judge of what is right and what is wrong, and then going to war for it. I mean, it's irrational at times because it is irrational. I mean, I've sat down and talked with these people. You got to be very careful because they can really get going. And tried to do it, you know, logically, and you quickly discover that logic has nothing to do with it.
No.
The pressures, though, of the threat presented by Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah and not simply international, but the international threats, but the potential domestic threat exposes the absurdity of the kind of positions that Jim's pointing out. We have to agree on what we are going to use, how we're going to use these tools for our mutual defense, which is a nice way of saying our individual and group survival. We're definitely under threat from these people. The threat is magnified by the existence of weapons of mass destruction, and we know the intent of these terrorists to use those types of weapons should they ever be able to acquire them and employ them. They will use them. The absurdity of the situation that Jim was alluding to vis-a-vis the ACLU positions on this is exposed by the degree of threat. Now, what you get often from these groups is to deny that the threat exists. Mm-hmm. The threat is
overblown,
exaggerated, or overblown. And the longer you go between incidents, like we've had with the latest terror bust or 9/11, the more these denial and accommodationist points of view gain a certain kind of credence or political viability. And yet, the fact is the threat remains there, and the tools, what protects you, are the very tools that they say they don't want you to use.
Well, what happens in practice, and I've heard this from people over in Europe as well as in the United States, is the government agencies, you know, security agencies and counterterrorism agencies, they know they have to operate under certain, you know, quote-unquote restrictions, and they basically ignore them as much as they can get away with and just go on with the job. I mean, for example, in Europe, the counterterrorism organizations in Germany, in France, Italy, all over, they basically are much more in sync with what we are trying to do than with what their own governments are saying. And they basically, Europeans can live with that. And we live with it too. The only time, you know, people get upset with the counterterrorism and the intelligence organizations is when they screw up. So they just live with a certain amount of constant abuse, you know, from various, you know, privacy activists or what have you, and just get on with the job. Because they know that the only time they're really going to get hurt is if they fail.
So what comes next? We've got these arrests. It looks like they're continuing to round people up. How far is this going to go, and what other threats are likely out there?
Well, again, this is where being a historian comes in handy. These upsurges of Islamic fundamentalism are nothing new, and indeed, they're fairly common in Islamic history. They come about every 50 or so years. It used to be they came at that cycle at different countries. You know, you had the Mahdi down in Sudan. In fact, they're just having, and if literally, they're having another, two or three generation jump of Mahdiism down in Sudan, which is why you've got a Islamic fundamentalist government down there. But because of the worldwide communications, you know, Al Jazeera and what have you, all of these cycles of Islamic fundamentalism and Islamic terrorism, as they go together, are now basically in sync. So they're happening all at once. So in effect, they're more dangerous because you have more of these wackos, you know, out there on a mission from God to kill people who don't agree with them. And a lot of them are actually acting in concert. And indeed, what you have happening in Iraq is you have two different cycles of Islamic fundamentalism, the Shia one and the Sunni one. I mean, they're literally operating side by side, in some cases killing each other in the name of Allah, but slightly different flavors of Allah. And the ironic thing, and this is what I'm hearing more and more from our correspondents in our email correspondents inside Iraq, Iraqis, they all say it's madness, and they're debating should they stay or should they just leave the country, which many of them have done. But they say that we basically, we got rid of one Saddam, and we've placed him with 1,000 others. You've got all these little warlords. A lot of them are religious leaders. They can order people to be killed, and they literally do it. A lot of these Iraqis you hear about being killed, they're being killed for religious reasons. Because they won't grow a beard, because they won't contribute enough to the mosque. You have literally you have thousands of Saddams now where you used to have one. And of course, as Iraqis are telling me, see, we have to get rid of all the Saddams before we can ever have peace in that country.
Well, that actually brings me to something. Michael Yon put up a fairly pessimistic post along those lines the other day. And he also thinks there's a lot of Iranian influence growing in Iraq. What's your take on what's likely to happen next, and what should we be doing there that we're not?
There's a great deal of Iranian influence, and I can speak from personal experience in Iraq, even in May of 2004, concern about Iranian shenanigans, Iranian financial support of factions inside Iraq, Iranian ideological support for factions inside Iraq. The Iranians are very afraid, Glenn and Helen, of a successful Iraqi democracy for a raft of reasons, not just the political reasons that you would immediately understand from the point of view of the mullahs in Tehran, because you know they're running this religious dictatorship, but there's also from the Iranian, Iranistan, that's Iran, the Persians, view of the Arabs living over in Mesopotamia, they believe themselves to be the cultural superiors to those desert dwellers and farmers that live in the Tigris and Euphrates Valley. And it's a blow to pride for the Iraqis to succeed at democracy when Iran is still in a theocratic dictatorship. So if these seem a little bit contradictory, understand that Tehran and Iran are filled with contradictions just like this. Aspirations for modernity, aspirations for a working economy, a productive economy, and at the same time you've got the Khomeini's crew out there with their own brand of the Islamic revolutionary madness that we were discussing a few moments ago.
So what
and there's
should
a
we
big
do?
Religious angle too, because you got to remember that the most sacred religious sites in the Shia branch of Islam
are in,
southern Iraq.
That's right, they're in Iraq.
And of course, many Iranians, they won't come out and say this, but they'd be down with the fact with annexing southern Iraq and making it a part of Iran, just as Arabistan, where most of their oil is in southwest Iran is part of Iran. Nobody likes to say that out loud, but believe me, everybody talks about
it. What do the Arabs feel about it? Who are outside of the Azeris and Kurds, who the Iranians have trouble with? Their Azeri and Kurd minorities, they have trouble with their Shia Arab minorities.
They just executed a bunch of them for setting up bombs last year.
I mean, the likelihood that their fear there too of a successful Iraq is that the Shia Arabs in Arabistan,
hey, that oil belongs to us.
Want to go across the river and Iraq.
One thing to keep in mind, you know, irony of ironies, that's what Saddam's war against Iran was all about. He thought he could grab Arabistan while the Iranians were all distracted with their religious revolution against the Shah. Didn't work.
That was Saddam's, part of Saddam's dream, and he thought that he would get a popular uprising among the Shia Arabs there inside Iran. So the Iranians have a number of reasons to keep Iraq unstable. I think the Iraqis, I really respect Michael Yon's work. He's a courageous journalist. He is informed. He's there on the ground. But the Iranians have not been very successful, nor have the Syrians, nor have al-Qaeda, in stopping what I get to take the long arc of the last 3 years from in Iraq. Three successful democratic elections. And Glenn, Helen, last month, one of the absolutely historically astonishing moments was in a democratically elected Iraqi prime minister, a Shia Arab, shows up at a joint session in Congress and says, Iraq is your ally in the war on terror. Thank you. We have gratitude to the United States for giving us the opportunity to become a democracy and essentially enter the modern world. And that was kind of lost. I didn't see it get I think the deserved attention of what an absolutely historically significant moment. And it was within 16 years of August 2nd, 1990, when Saddam invaded Kuwait.
So what should the United States be doing?
Have not been very successful.
There's a very large populist movement going through the Muslim world, especially the Arab countries, about what should we do about our past and modernization. And these are basically the reformers. And this is something that started there. This is nothing that the CIA cooked up. They've actually been holding conferences. One, in fact, was hosted by Saudi Arabia. Or at least the Al Saud family. So a lot of people in the Muslim world realize that they're at a fork in the road. Do they try and go back to the 8th century, or do they enter the 21st? Unfortunately, the people who basically want to go back are willing to kill over the issue. So it's a sort of a family feud that they're going to have to settle largely by themselves. We can help them with things like removing Saddam, but they still have to decide among themselves, what direction they're all going to go in.
So it's going to be a fight, and expect it to be a fight, and it's a long-term fight. The thing is, the Iraqis, if you look at it again through a 15-year time span, have accomplished remarkable things despite finagling from Tehran and finagling from Damascus, and also a stream of jihadists. Jim wrote this, first wrote this 2.5 years ago, and I chuckled at it. It's not funny, but talking about how the Saudis and a few other countries in the Persian Gulf Arab regions were exporting their own internal problems as jihadists into Iraq. Just go ahead and get on the line, go on up, however you connect into Syria. Not that there were a huge number of these people, but these were the ones that likely al-Qaeda recruits just going up to Iraq and get killed by the Americans.
Well, let's move to Israel and Hezbollah now. Israel, I guess, is allegedly expanding its invasion now, though Michael Totten was on the border and was just saying now that he doesn't really see a whole lot of action. What's going on there, and what do you see as the end game there?
It's mostly local politics. Olmert, you know, the government in Israel, like any government in Israel, is a coalition government. Right now, the majority, I've heard 70-80%, is behind the war, but the politicians know that if there are a lot of dead Israeli soldiers, you know, that will fade. You got to remember that while they may have only had, well, have 50 killed so far, we have 50 times the population of Israel, so multiply it by 50 to get it into American terms. That's 2,500 dead. They cannot afford to suffer a lot of casualties. Now, there are some people in Israel and the Israeli military said we should do a blitzkrieg, but there you're talking hundreds, maybe thousands of dead. The Israeli tactics are like the United States Marines. Hey, they're a little straight up the middle. They win, but they take a lot of casualties, just like the Marines are even doing in Iraq. So right now, the government would like to take some kind of deal that they can sell at home. But everybody's watching the polls. It's a democracy. So, you know, there can't be any hidden agenda because you cannot get away with anything that the people will not agree to.
I thought that Israel needs ultimately, and it wouldn't force, it's not just Israel alone, but Israel to solve the situation in southern Lebanon, its own security. You've got to address the source of the problem, which is in Damascus and Tehran.
That's, and in Beirut, where there are a bunch of cowards.
Yes. But what we've seen, I think the Israelis have decided on the option, on the Hezbollah cancer removal option. And this is a way that I've described this in a couple of other radio programs that I've done, is think of this process of probing and attacking launch sites and going after bunkers as a siege. It is a siege because the Israelis are trying to deny movement by Hezbollah fighters in and out of the southern Lebanon zone, and certainly deny logistic support, resupply of these fighters there. But it's also an information siege. What the Israelis want to do in order to minimize casualties is identify every possible trap that Hezbollah has out there, and that takes time. It also means you have to probe, and it means you have to watch constantly and compare the data of 20 minutes ago to the data of 2 minutes ago to see what to find supply lines, rat lines, communications. Communications movement nodes and the like, so that you aren't surprised when you actually begin to destroy Hezbollah bit by bit in southern Lebanon.
They have to keep their casualties down.
It takes time. If you're going to do this, and that looks to me like what they're going to do, is that you have to spend the time, take the time to identify every one of these fixed, or as many of these fixed positions as you possibly can. Because what Hezbollah wants the Israelis to do is go after the obvious bunker, and then they're going to try to shoot or wound two or three Israeli soldiers and cause, inflict casualties, that's military attrition, but also as political attrition. And this is a tactic, this is an old tactic. The Japanese wanted to do this on Japanese islands. As a matter of fact, if you think of southern Lebanon as a peculiar type
Okinawa.
Island in the Pacific, you'll have an interesting and, I think, useful historical analogy. But what's different about it is, from the Israeli perspective, is precision munitions, the ability to take their time. They're not operating on MacArthur's or Nimitz's timeline for taking the island. They do have the potential of a UN ceasefire as quote-unquote ending the battle. But if it's a certain kind of ceasefire, where you have French and German soldiers with a very robust rules of engagement. Maybe the Israelis think they can live with that. I don't. I think the Israelis want to spend the next 2 to 4 weeks destroying as much of Hezbollah in place as they possibly can.
And they have done a lot of damage. They obviously, for security reasons, they can't announce what they know they have destroyed. But from the information I'm getting from Beirut, from inside Lebanon, they have done great damage. A lot of Hezbollah people are not happy at the moment.
Well, about a month ago on one of my Creator Syndicates columns, and I think it was the one that was about July 15th, I said that Condi Rice needed to buy the Israelis 2 months. That was a figure I put on it. And looking at it here on August the 11th when we record this, I think that was about right. I think that was the kind of time frame they needed. We'll see. We'll certainly know by September 15th. We may have a ceasefire resolution that the Israelis agree to here shortly, and we'll have to reanalyze from there. But from looking at what I thought they needed to accomplish on the ground, I thought it was 4 to 8 weeks.
Yeah, and they're not. Got to remember, they're not going after territory. They're going after assets. Some of them are up walking on 2 feet. Some of them are buried, in bunkers. A lot of them are buildings which are no longer there. Hezbollah has lost a lot. And remember, one thing that kept them going was the money. They were basically over $500 million a year operation, which basically bought a lot of loyalty, while they've lost a lot of their walking around money.
I think that point is absolutely crucial. And I had seen various estimates of what Iran pumped into Hezbollah. I remember seeing one, maybe a year ago, and the figure $288 million a year is what they were giving them. I think that's on the short side. I think the figure that Jim alludes to, which we've now seen, $450 to $500 million a year is what Iran...
Well, about half of that comes from Iran. The other half comes from internal sources, many of which have been compromised when the Syrians pulled out. There were a lot of illegal operations, drugs, counterfeiting, smuggling, what have you, which have all of a sudden gone bye-bye now that the Syrian army is gone, and that has hurt Hezbollah.
But then you're saying, Jim, that 288 figure may have been accurate for the Iranians.
Just for the Iranians.
Just for the Iranians.
They're putting in. And that is not very popular back in Iran. I keep hearing Iran.
That's a lot of money. Yeah.
That, the Iranian government has done nothing for the poor of Iran. And the Iranians are not stupid. They know the price of oil is through the roof, and everybody's saying, where's mine? And then they hear about all this money going to, Lebanon, and of course the story is that the Lebanese are rich. Of course, the only pictures you see are the rebuilt Beirut and what have you, not the guy scrimping by, in the Shia suburbs or down in the Beqa Valley. And so the Iranian popular attitude towards Lebanon is let them live by themselves. Let's keep the money at home.
Now, is Syria getting a wave of refugees from Lebanon, too? Is that putting any pressure on the Syrians?
Yeah, about 10-15% of the Shia population has lit off for Syria. The reason for that is very simple. The Shia basically cut a deal with the devil. The Shia, for generations were the poorest minority. They were about 35% of the population. During the civil war, they were getting the worst of it until Iran stepped in after the Shah was gone and founded Hezbollah and started funneling money, guns, military advisors, you name it. All of a sudden, the Shia got some respect. Now, that did not go down well. They also got a Syrian occupation army, which was great for the Shia, not so great for the majority of Lebanese. The majority of Lebanese, despite what they're saying, about, the Israelis, the devils, they're killing us, they still have it in for the Shia, and the Shia know it. And they're voting with their feet, and you've seen which way the polls are going these days, right into Syria.
Well, let's turn to another issue. Let's look at Ethiopia. Do you think Ethiopia is going to go to war against Somalia?
I think Ethiopia is already at war.
Yeah.
This has been going on for some time, too, because, look, the Ogaden region of Ethiopia is considered by many Somalis as to be Somali territory, peopled by ethnic Somalis. And if Strategy Page... this is off the top of my head, but I believe we had a report, I want to say it was 2001 or 2002, of Ethiopian troops in Somalia, but they were in that breakaway corner, Puntland.
Yeah.
They were in Puntland. Okay, Jim, yeah. there, did you remember that? Remember that as well. And it was, from the sources on that report were pretty darn good, as in people their in Puntland saying, "We see Ethiopian soldiers in trucks driving around," and then they pulled out. Ethiopia has worked an economic agreement with the Somaliland Republic. That's the other portion of Somalia, and this is the northwestern segment that is essentially operating as a separate country from the rest of Somalia. So the Ethiopians are interested in using the having access to the ports there in that part of Somalia or in Somaliland as an option, either going through Sudan, and of course their old port in Eritrea is they don't. A lot with the Eritreans.
For thousands of years, the Ethiopians, who are basically highland people, and of course for the last 2,000 years Christians, have been trying to, get ports, where Somalia is. They've never been able to do it because they were always outclassed militarily by the Arabs and later the Turks, by the Muslims, in effect. And what they're afraid of right now in Somalia is that these Islamic courts, which is basically a Taliban-type operation, which people, again, are supporting because it's preferable to the anarchy of just all the warlords. Now, it's literally the same thing as what happened in Afghanistan in the early 90s. The Ethiopians do not want fundamentalist Muslims next door, because about half the population of Ethiopia is Muslim, and that is the half of the population that is in a state of unrest, almost continuous unrest. So the last thing they want, I mean, it's one thing, the various Muslim groups in Ethiopia are in unrest, for separatists, for, economic reasons, for political reasons and whatnot. They don't want religion added to the mix, because so far, religion hasn't been a big issue in Ethiopia. It's mostly been tribe or politics or money. But they've seen what happens when religion gets mixed into, all those other factors. They want no part of it. So they're willing to go quite a ways in order to stop the Islamic courts. That's going to get interesting.
Ethiopia also has a regional ally in this, and that's Kenya. Kenya doesn't want to be swamped by Somali refugees.
Because in normal times they're swamped by Somali raiders.
The last thing they want
is them to have their families inside of Kenya as well.
So it's not simply an Ethiopian show. Now, we've had some analysis again on Strategy Page about the effectiveness of the Ethiopian army. The Ethiopian army has some really very bad units, but they are, as the analysis we had points out, they are soldiers, and they fight like soldiers. The Islamic Courts Union fights like what, Jim?
Bandits.
They're fighters, yeah.
They're warriors.
Warriors
and, against soldiers.
So it would be different than fighting the little warlord groups. You'd actually be engaging an army in the kind of terrain where soldier force backed up by artillery and the other assets the Ethiopian military can bring to bear would be a formidable fighting force for the Islamic Courts Union. I think the ICU, the Islamic Courts Union, sees the Ethiopians as a real challenge, too.
Yes, and that's why they're making so much noise about, raising the nationalism, flag, as it were.
Which is funny, because the Islamic Courts Union, the only reason that some of their even being tolerated in Mogadishu is because they said they were going to stop all the fighting,
Another thing to keep in mind is that the Islamic Courts Union is not that strong of a union. It's basically a confederation of warlords who have basically decided that peace is preferable to all this anarchy, and the only source of peace historically in Somalia is the tribal elders, which includes, religious leaders. And of course, Sharia law was there. Everybody could agree on that. It's draconian. It's a little rough around the edges, but it's something people will generally accept if it's applied fairly. And so a lot of these warlords are simply giving their religious leaders in their tribes, a prominent place, as it were. But that can change very quickly. However, in order to making that deal with the devil, so to speak, it's also allowed Al Qaeda people and various other Islamic, radicals, a place to hide. They do get a friendly hearing there now, because the religious leaders in Somalia, who are always, if you're going to be an Islamic religious leader, you 9 times out of 10, you are by definition an Islamic conservative. And basically Al Qaeda, their preaching is Islamic conservatism, to an extreme. So there is a problem there with providing another home for al-Qaeda, but it's not unanimous in Somalia. Somalia was never a really religious country, so this is more of a temporary thing, but even a temporary place to hide for al-Qaeda can be dangerous for many of the rest of us.
Well, they also have the money to be out of the chaos to buy some effective protection or buy arms and buy friends in the chaos.
But it's cheaper to buy religious leaders than it is warlords. Warlords are much pricier. I mean, literally.
All right, last question. What should we be watching for over the next couple of weeks?
Nothing new, really. I think concentrating on Lebanon is important because Hezbollah is one of those linchpin terrorist organizations, and they are at the moment being taken apart. Their propaganda notwithstanding. There's also an interesting information war going on there. Just as it came out with the Palestinians, Hezbollah has been staging a lot of atrocities, for the benefit of the media, and they've been called out on it. We can thank the blogosphere for that, I think, because you have many more eyes, scrutinizing these media events. The Iraq is not going to change. It's hard to do any serious analysis on Iraq because it's playing out. It's the same old song repeated over and over again. It's like 99 bottles of beer on the wall. So nothing exciting is going to come out of there. Afghanistan, the big story that's going to come out by the time in the next month or so when fall rolls around is they huffed and they puffed and nothing happened. Except they put a lot of kids out of school.
I'm going to take a different attack on Iraq. I think there is a big story, but it is a repetitive big story, and that is the daily courage of the Iraqi people, witnessed by what Prime Minister Maliki said in July here when he visited the United States, is the daily courage of the Iraqi people to say, we're going to make this happen. And I think that gets ignored by so many reporters, by the mainstream media, that the Iraqi people see that they have an investment in this new government.
Thank God the people of Iraq don't give a damn what the New York Times
says. Well, they don't, and they don't. they
be grateful for that.
But Jim, you know the point I'm making.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really a class one.
Iraqis are going to go ahead and do what they have to do,
that's
no matter
exactly
what.
Exactly right. And the sad lesson is that freedom has never been given to anybody. They've ultimately earned it, paid for it in some shape, form, or fashion, and usually it's involved some type of hard struggle involving bloodshed.
That's one thing I've heard Iraqi Americans say.
I have heard them say that too.
Say that they go over there and they ask them, how do we get democracy? And they basically tell them points like, you got to fight for it.
Well, look, I had Iraqis telling me that when I was over there on active duty. I mean, it was something that would come up, and they were aware of what the issues were, and it's tough. And the thing is, it's tough to face it day by day with you and your family under the gun.
They like to make jokes about what happened to our Christian slave warriors.
Well,
because when we came in,
they're still there.
They have a different sense of humor. They said, "Oh, this is amusing." They make jokes about how the Americans are doing. They're fighting for them because they could never overthrow Saddam.
But now
it's like humor during the Soviet Russian humor during the Soviet period. Now they're saying, "What is the matter with our Christian slave warriors? They won't do our work. We have to do it. This is terrible."
Here's the other thing that I'd look at, and that's Mexico. No, I don't see Mexico as being southern Lebanon or Iraq or same Somalia, heaven forbid. But the situation and how the hung election in Mexico, the July 2nd presidential election, it's the U.S.'s southern border. You were asking, Glenn, what we should be concerned about. Hope that López Obrador's PRD party decides that civil disobedience is the route and that they don't move to further types of street action, street violence, as some of the PRD spokesmen, at least I've seen reported through the some of the wire services, had began suggesting at the end of July, because Mexico, it's clear that Mexico is going to have a hard time. The next president, who's probably going to be Felipe Calderon of the PAN party, is going to have a hard time politically. He's elected on a very, very, very slender margin. But the PRD has got to act with maturity, that word again, and accept whatever the final election results are from the judicial tribunal. If they don't, and you have recurrent violence, recurrent demonstrations, like the extended one you've seen by the teachers' protest in Oaxaca, then Mexico is going to be in turmoil, and that is a lurking problem for the United States.
Well, something to keep an eye on is the opinion polls in Mexico, and what they're showing is Obrador is losing a lot of votes with all the civil disobedience. If they held the election again, there wouldn't be this problem,
except,
because he'd lose by a substantial
except
margin.
Except in one place. Where is the one place that he's
Mexico City.
Mexico City, which is
where the media is.
And where his base is, too.
See, that's why New York City distorts American politics. We
well,
got all
that,
the wackos, and we got all the media. It's
on
a bad combination.
On that
well,
note,
that's
maybe
Jim Delegate
time
left.
Well, thank you guys so much, and we hope we can correct a little of the distortion with this Knoxville-based media enterprise.
All right.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, as usual, it was like drinking from a fire hose of information. Those guys know a lot about everything.
Yeah, I learn a little bit every time we talk to them.
It's always fun to have them on, and I think a lot of people seem to like it. I'm just sorry that events in the world are such that we have an unending supply of material for them to talk about. The good news is we also have an unending supply of these shows. We hope you like that. You can subscribe via iTunes or get us at glennandhelenshow.com. We'll be back whenever we feel like it. In the meantime, have fun on the internet.
Talk to you next time.
Time's right, Lord, you can't delay. Or something's gotta give, but you don't.